With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with the Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation magazine. I'm Jeet here. I'm writer for The Nation magazine. The podcast is available on all major podcasting platforms and some radio shows. Today, I want to take up the issue of Donald Trump's foreign policy, which is the subject of an excellent essay in the New York Times by Stephen Wertheim, who is a senior fellow at American Statecraft Program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And he's also a visiting lecturer at Yale Law School. And in this piece, Wertheim, who's been a guest on the program before, takes a very broad, systematic view of Donald Trump's foreign policy and the sort of contradictions that we're all wrestling with, which is that on the one hand, Trump ran both in 2024 and 2016 as the sort of candidate of peace and of a different foreign policy where the United States would try to disengage from some of the unproductive wars they had been involved with, but that in practice, Trump gets caught in the same quagmire that earlier presidents have. And this happened certainly in his first term, and it's happening now. And I think Stephen's piece is very valuable for thinking through why this is happening. So first of all, welcome to the program.
Wonderful to be here back with you.
So did you want to run down your main argument? And particularly, I appreciated the sort of systematic focus of the question of there's a structural problem, which all presidents have, which is that the American empire is overstretched and has all these commitments and so far is able to maintain them. But I mean, you got to ask how many wars on how many continents this nation is able to fight continuously. And even now, I mean, I think with both Ukraine and the Middle East, we're seeing some of the limits of the empire. So there's these structural problems, overreach. And then there's Donald Trump, who, as I said, ran as an alternative to the foreign policy consensus, but is also perhaps not the most systematic thinker in the world and is more of a counterpuncher and an agent of reaction to situations, and perhaps not the best person to deal with a structural problem. But so that's maybe the overview of the situation. But do you want to run down what your thinking is?
Well, I wrote the piece out of frustration on a few levels. First of all, our political debate is far too reactive to rhetoric on foreign policy compared to results. So once again, just as in Trump's first term, there was so much talk about, wow, you know, Trump says he wants peace. He's criticized Western interventionism, as he did in a speech in Saudi Arabia. There was a lot of talk that Trump was looking to pull American power way back overseas and have a sphere of influence world and let Russia have its way in Europe and let China have its way in Asia, and the United States would stay focused on the Western hemisphere. That would be an enormous change. And then what do we see? We see actually Donald Trump has done none of that at all. And on top of that, he bombed Iran. So this gave me flashbacks to the first term of Trump, where, again, the rhetoric was all about Trump is an isolationist, you know, in the mold of pre-World War II U.S. foreign policy. And then he bombed Syria a few months in. And people had to go, oh, that's interesting. And then they forgot about it, I guess. So first of all, we give either too much credit or too much blame to Trump, depending on where one stands, for being a kind of revolutionary figure when it comes to American political military policy. And we should judge much more on results. And if you do that, 6 months in, what I see is a president who hasn't delivered peace, whether in Europe or in the Middle East, and doesn't seem to be on track to do so. And as you suggested, Cheat, I think the fundamental problem is that this is a thoroughly situational man facing a deeply structural problem.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like he likes the fact that the United States is indefinitely globally postured with its military, that it has all these defense commitments to dozens of countries around the world. And yet he is not, does not seem inclined to kind of grapple with the basic questions of, well, what countries does America need to be committed to defend? What countries should it not be committed to defend? And therefore, you know, once I have the answer to that admittedly difficult question, you know, that gives you a lot of clarity on, well, what should we do now? That's just not his approach. His starting point is, here's the world that I find. I don't like it. I'm going to throw a lot of things up at the wall. I'm going to try to make, you know, I have a lot of grievances, and actually America's alliances are a great platform for his grievances. But he has preferred for 4 years plus now 6 months to not to retract American military power, but to transact over it, right? To try to cut deals and make the terms of American military engagement and commitment, you know, a little more favorable for the United States. For example, by getting European allies to spend more on defense. But I look at that and I think, okay, maybe that's an improvement on what came before. Maybe. But European allies spending more of their economies on their militaries does not guarantee or even imply that the United States will, in fact, do less and spend less and risk less if there is a conflict in Europe. So where is the big change? And in this regard, look, people find his rhetoric sometimes refreshing if you've been concerned with American overextension. But so much of his rhetoric and the foundational concepts are not even new. Like Joe Biden left Afghanistan and then said the era of major military operations to remake other countries is over. Barack Obama was also capable of saying something similar. And peace through strength, Trump's foreign policy mantra, has literally been featured in every Republican Party platform since 1980, with the one exception of 2004, when probably peace through strength sounded too peaceful for George W. Bush and the GOP at that time. This is not even new rhetoric.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think, I mean, I'm glad that you emphasized that both the rhetoric is not new. And I think in some ways the problem is not new, that the kind of overstretch of American empire, one really wants to think about it, the crisis point really came in the late 60s and early 70s with the sort of, you know, failure of American policy in Vietnam. And there have been, you know, different approaches to retrenchment, starting with the Nixon-Kissinger attempt to create a new balance of power by bringing in China. And certainly there have been prominent voices, especially actually on the right-wing side, more than the liberal side, who have viewed NATO as an anchor or as a unnecessary expense. One saw that already in the 1980s under Reagan, and Ross Perot took that up. So these are like longstanding issues. And I think Trump rhetorically has exploited the fact that there is a great deal of concern. But, you know, like, as you said, his whole approach, this transactional, let's make a deal approach, doesn't allow him to address the systematic concerns that he brought up. And maybe, I mean, like, it's maybe worth thinking about like the kind of resistance that he is meeting, which I think any president would meet, but maybe he's less equipped to deal with. Like in the first term, I really thought one big problem was that he had this like rhetoric of change, but then he inherited a GOP that was top heavy with people that were very committed to the status quo, and particularly kind of like a sort of neoconservative foreign policy thinkers. And he ended up giving a lot of positions to people who fundamentally disagreed with his worldview. And, you know, like personnel is policy. Like if you have people like John Bolton on your staff, they're going to carry out a John Bolton foreign policy, even if you're Donald Trump as president. Now, in the second term, there seems to have been like at least some attempt to address this by bringing in more anti-restrainers. And then Trump seems to have or the people around him have a greater awareness that you actually need people who are on the same page with the president on this. But even so, that hasn't worked. And maybe the weight of that foreign policy consensus, that, whatever we want to call it, the military industrial complex, the deep state, whatever term you give for it, that still seems to be overpowering. But what's your sense? Why is the power of inertia so strong here?
Trump is out of excuses, right? Yeah. That's the flip side of what you said. He can't blame his advisors anymore because he's able to appoint basically whoever he wants. He got Tulsi Gabbard confirmed as director of national intelligence. He's chosen to have Marco Rubio as national security advisor, secretary of state, and archivist or something. There's probably a few other titles I'm forgetting. So yeah, he has made different personnel choices in this administration, but I think the personnel choices reflect now the real incoherence within the mind of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So I think we have an administration intriguingly staffed with people who have deep fundamental disagreements about American power in the world, more so than in any administration in the post-Cold War era. But in a way, that makes it harder to make strategic change because to do that, you have to get everybody on board with a new policy that's going to have a lot of moving parts, and everybody has to be committed to doing it. And it's still going to face reluctance or some forms of resistance from other parts of the political system. So I think a very telling moment was when Republicans in Congress signed a letter calling for zero enrichment, that the U.S. position in Iran nuclear negotiations must be that Iran adopt, make a huge concession, don't enrich any uranium, right? Giving up its legal right to enrich uranium at low levels, suitable only for civilian and research purposes. Let's unpack that just a little bit more. Republicans in Congress, when they wrote that letter, were able to say, we affirm the position of the Trump administration in seeking zero enrichment. So the Trump administration had already backed itself into the corner of adopting a goal that is completely unnecessary to achieve what really appears to be Donald Trump's personal aim of preventing Iran from getting an actual nuclear weapon. And then the Republicans in Congress seized, somebody convinced him or made statements to get the administration gradually more committed to zero enrichment. And then Trump ultimately has affirmed that. And that's part of the reason why the negotiations haven't borne more fruit. So, and now, after the strikes on Iran, if Trump doesn't come back with genuine zero enrichment, I fear that it will not work for him politically, because if he comes back with something that looks like much more of a concession, that kind of undermines the whole narrative that his military strikes knocked Iran way back, that they're desperate, etc. So that's an interesting case, right? Because it illustrates how Trump still faces a lot of constraints from his own party, especially members of Congress who tend not to share Trump's more restraint-oriented instincts. But at the same time, Trump himself is quite incoherent and short-term in his thinking, situational in his thinking. So it's not like his true vision is a vision of American military retrenchment and restraint in the world, and he's being held back. It's really on him now to show us what his vision is, because he can move his party, right, if he really wants to, that's for sure. And I think we're seeing him fail so far, if indeed his true goal is a more peaceful world.
Yeah.
And a U.S. security policy that actually reflects the interests of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I think your emphasis on incoherence is exactly right. I mean, there's both the incoherence of the personnel of having, administration with very divergent views, and a president not willing to set a clear agenda, which has basically led to what we've seen, which is just factional fights of people, you know, trying to get each other fired all the time. But then also a president who maybe doesn't understand the details of foreign policy. I mean, I think a lot of people of your ilk at the Quincy Institute and elsewhere were saying beforehand, like, you know, this zero enrichment, this is a trap and this will lead you into war, and which is exactly what happened. And I think that the Republicans in Congress knew it was a trap and knew what they were doing. But I don't think, like, I don't see any evidence that Trump himself understood how he was boxed in to like a position that like actually went against his own stated goals. So, I mean, that lack of like focus on details or inability to understand the process, like, I think that's part of the story. But I'd be curious to know what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, you can't expect presidents to have a command of details of foreign policy. In many areas, you know, they're really responsible for appointing good people who can help them work on those details and setting a direction and then making key decisions. But what we see is an administration that doesn't have much of a functional interagency process, as they call it, right? It's Donald Trump leading the charge. Mm-hmm. Somebody tells him something, he gets an idea, and then he says it. And then people kind of create a process around that. And then maybe Trump changes his mind. I also think Trump has a belief that he can kind of maneuver situations like nothing is permanent. He is not known as an ideological man, but if he does have like a personal ideology with respect to foreign policy, it's that every interaction with the state in Trump's mind is meant to lead to a deal. Mm-hmm. The teleology of the deal.
Yeah.
I think Trump was able to kind of convince himself, look, it's all part of the dance. I can say zero enrichment one day and I can take it back the next day. And you know what? Maybe he can kind of take it back. Mm-hmm. But also, these positions have effects in the world.
Yeah.
And people who saw the zero enrichment demand as a poison pill, they were correct. Mm-hmm. It was. And the fact that Trump also set a 60-day deadline, that was utilized by the Israeli government of Netanyahu to say, okay, 60 days are up and we want to do these strikes. And reportedly Trump gave, I think very characteristically, a yellow light, not a green light, not a red light. Yeah. Okay, maybe. Mm-hmm. And I personally, you know, I think my guess is that Trump convinced himself, okay, there'll be some strikes. We'll see what happens. Maybe that actually helps me get a deal. So he still believes that a deal is possible, but I fear that the whole trajectory of the last couple months has set back the prospects for a deal, and one that he could have gotten in the first place by just sticking to his core, what I think is his core desire to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, mm-hmm. you know, not going forward with weaponization, mm-hmm. as opposed to eliminating all enrichment of uranium.
Yeah, it does seem like he does think his options are always open and that there's no long-term consequences, which I think there's some realism in that, in the sense that because the United States is such a big force in the world, other countries are willing to overlook its actions. I mean, particularly the Iranians, I do think that they have shown a great deal of restraint and openness to let's put bygones in the past. But I mean, I also feel like there's only so far you could go with that. Let's sort of survey the world, because I think that the process that you've described, we see elsewhere, and like particularly in Europe, this kind of mixed messaging, setting of deadlines, over promising, and then shifting back and forth. One sees that with regard to Russia and Ukraine. Do you want to like explain how that dynamic is playing out there?
Yeah, a lot of parallels to the Iran case. So Trump has set now, I don't know, 2-3 deadlines with respect to the war in Ukraine. There was like the first 24 hours of taking office, then it was 100 days.
Oh, and I should add, I mean, this deadline strategy, we also see it with tariffs, and it's also not really working there as well, but continue.
Yes. So, you know, I think his initial impulse was, I'm going to show up. People respect me personally. They didn't respect Biden. I'm also more flexible than Biden. I'm going to show a genuine interest in bringing the parties together to negotiate peace. And what's the quickest way we can get to peace? So let's hammer out something simple. Mm-hmm. But it was always going to be a very complex negotiation. Maybe you could get a quick ceasefire for a limited period of time, perhaps a bounded ceasefire. But to actually resolve this conflict, we know what the issues are. There are many, and they touch on issues beyond Ukraine as well. So it was going to take a determined effort. And because the parties hadn't been talking for quite some time, you know, the expectation should have been more modest. Let's start the discussion. But this conflict is likely to go on for a while, and we want to keep talking in that time and make progress rather than hope for a big breakthrough and then get frustrated and start, you know, blaming one side or the other and then shifting U.S. policy accordingly. And so that's the pattern that we've seen with respect to Ukraine. And it's just kind of hard to justify. I actually think on this issue, I'm not sure the U.S. position in the Middle East is better today than it was when Trump took office. I think it's worse.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah.
But actually, with respect to Europe and the war in Ukraine, from a certain perspective, I could say we're in a better spot. The taboo that had arisen on negotiations has broken down, and Trump deserves credit for doing that. The Ukrainians and Russians are talking now. And the Ukrainian government, I mean, even that ugly spat in the Oval Office between Trump and Zelensky, which was, to put it mildly, not ideal, you know, served a productive purpose. I mean, Trump was arguing against the domino theory that Zelensky was putting forward about, you know, if Russia gets us, then it's a hop, skip, and a jump to the United States. And Trump was like, no, that's not right. And you know what? Trump was right about that. And Zelensky was saying, I don't want to even think about stopping this conflict until there is a major U.S. security guarantee for me. And Trump said, no. You've got to make peace first. Then we talk about the other. Because he's not willing to give a security guarantee. And I happen to think a very strong form of a U.S. security guarantee is a bad idea. Wouldn't be credible. And isn't in the interest of the United States. So there was some real substance at stake in that dispute. And afterwards, we have seen the Ukrainian government shift and become more willing to talk peace and envision a peace with less maximalist terms than before. So I'll even give credit, you know, some limited credit to Trump for bringing that about. But the fantasy that the war was going to end really quickly just by showing up and wanting it to end was exactly that. And now if Trump is going to give more weapons to Ukraine and contemplate forms of escalation, we'll see, then he ought to have figured that out to begin with, to put more pressure on Russia to say, look, I'm not just going to walk away from this. So you need to factor that into your calculations about what Russia can achieve and endure if it continues to fight this war.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. And I want to underscore this aspect of the sort of positive thing, and which actually does explain one reason why some voters did turn to Trump and did turn to Trump on foreign policy, which is this willingness to talk and to negotiate, which is very different from the Biden administration. Like, I think that for whatever reason, Biden seemed very averse to negotiations, both in Russia, with Iran in the Middle East, and really with China. Like, Biden's vision of foreign policy seemed to be, you build up alliances, you build up NATO, you build up AUKUS, you build up the Abraham Accords, and that's it. The second half of this is, why are you building up these alliances if not to negotiate with your adversary? Like, I did not see a lot of that under Biden. And so Trump's willingness to make a deal, I think, is something that you have to acknowledge. His willingness to talk, even, that is a major step forward. Having said that, I'm wondering, like, from the Russian point of view, and this also applies to Iran, given how erratic Trump has been and how he shifts from one side to the other, does it make sense for them to negotiate with the United States that is so erratic? And, like, I've always thought that, you know, like, one danger with Trump is that exact mixed messaging, which we saw in the first term as well, where Trump seemed open to making negotiations with Putin, but the actual Trump foreign policy, Kerry executed by his advisors, was very anti-Russian, which included sending more weapons to Ukraine. And one has to, like, try to think of the world as it's seen from the outside, from the point of view of American adversaries. And as you said, you know, the rhetoric and the reality are very different. Well, if the rhetoric and reality are very different, then why would Putin want to negotiate with this guy? Why not just continue on the battlefield? And I think the same applies to Iran. Like, why try to reopen nuclear negotiations? Why not just do what they're doing, which is withdraw from inspections and then, you know, like keep the threat of building nuclear weapons on the table? Yeah, do you, with thoughts on that, like ways in which like Trump's erraticness, you know, makes deal making very hard.
Yeah, I mean, he says he wants to be unpredictable, and he really is. And people all around the world and in this country were scratching their heads to try to think through what his foreign policy would be. And they've been scratching their heads for ever since then, as they've seen it unfold. My sense is that neither the Russians nor the Iranians were jumping up and down after Trump was elected, and that Russians doubted the ability of Trump to deliver on stated intentions, because they had seen in his first term that Russia really didn't get anything from Trump's often admiring statements about Vladimir Putin and expression of desire for a better relationship with Russia. That said, I think that of Trump's second presidency, like it's a somewhat different Trump. It's a different administration with different advisors. And it did seem like Trump was more willing than before to actually make concessions to U.S. adversaries to get things that he wanted. So I think the Iranians did, despite everything Trump did to them in the first term, they saw the opportunity to get back into a nuclear agreement with the United States. And the Russians, I think, maybe even more skeptical than the Iranians, but they have had extensive discussions. And I think some of them at least saw that there might be an opportunity this time to improve the relationship with the United States if the war can be settled in a way that they weren't able to do under Trump one. And I think that opportunity might still exist, but the if is a huge if, right? If the war can be ended. So, yeah, adversaries are having to try to figure out this guy, this cipher, really. But how much can they really trust them? Not much. And the Iranians in particular now have literally been bombed when they were continuing to negotiate. So I agree with you that they've shown a high degree of flexibility and pragmatism despite the attack on their country. But, you know, they still have a limit, and they're not backing away from their right to enrich uranium either.
No. I mean, I think that's basically right. There might still be a deal, but certainly I think anything that Trump has done has encouraged that. The other aspect of European policy, which one might give Trump some credit for, is getting the Europeans to sort of step up to the plate and investing more in their own defense, which I think any sort of idea of a restrained American foreign policy should have that as a component, and both in Europe and the Middle East and in Asia. So we have seen, Europeans, and where I am in Canada, like commitment of governments to more military spending. But the flip side of that, one would think, would be like American taking advantage of that to deal with the problem of overstretch and withdrawing. And one hasn't seen that. And that's the sort of point that you make in your essay. Do you want to talk about that? Like, what are you getting if you're getting both the NATO allies to spend more on the military, but the U.S. is actually not cutting back?
I guess I think about it more these days because it's hard to imagine the Pentagon budget going down.
Yeah.
But just in terms of where is the U.S. taking on the risk that if there is a conflict between an adversary and a U.S. ally, the U.S. will be drawn into that conflict. So this is where I'm quite skeptical that the pushing allies to spend more on defense improves the situation much for the United States. The terms of art used to discuss European security are burden sharing versus burden shifting. So part of Trump seems interested in just getting allies to spend more. And if they do, then Trump will remain committed to their security, maybe as committed as before, maybe even more committed. And that's kind of where we are at the moment, I think, because the NATO summit, the recent NATO summit, produced nothing but smiles from President Trump. And it was all about NATO allies pledging to spend 5% of their economies on military-related purposes. It's really 3.5% on militaries. Another 1.5% on infrastructure, things related to being able to engage in combat. But if that's all we get at the end of the Trump administration, the United States is likely to remain equally overstretched.
Yeah.
If not more so, because adversaries are generally strengthening a bit. And for the Europeans, they're likely to spend money on things that don't render them independent of the United States, but rather are designed to keep the United States in and committed to their defense. So the alternative would be burden shifting, where the U.S. Pulls back, its military presence in Europe is trimmed, and that also shows the lower commitment, political commitment of the United States to European defense. And Europeans need to step up and plug the gap. And also, I think command, supreme command of NATO forces ought to be transferred into European hands from American hands too.
Yeah.
And that actually would make good on what Secretary of Defense Hegseth seemed to be saying in February when he announced, he went to Europe and he announced that Europeans must take ownership of conventional defense on the continent. But so far, we just haven't seen steps in that direction. Now, the Pentagon is undertaking a force posture review that should come out in the coming months. And that would be an essential step toward seeing a shift of the U.S. military presence away from Europe. If it doesn't happen there, I become very pessimistic that it'll happen at all at any point in this administration.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that this sort of what one would consider the rational policy of sort of burden shifting runs into a conflict with Trump's fundamental nature that we talked about, which is that sort of transactional nature, which is that Trump is not thinking in strategic terms. He's thinking really in terms of like a mafia boss. Like he wants NATO to exist as a protection racket, and that he thinks it hasn't been run as a good protection racket, where like money is coming into the U.S. and that the allies make concessions so that the U.S. will protect them from like Putin or whatever foes that they have. And so it seems like as long as Trump has that, you know, transactional view that, you know, this alliance is a protection racket, that like, you know, the whole like burden shifting doesn't seem like a possibility. Like you would actually need a more fundamental shift in like the thinking of Trump and really the thinking of that cohort of people in the Republican Party that want a different foreign policy.
I think that's right. They are two often conflated but very different positions, burden sharing and burden shifting. And think about what it means if the president's view is that alliances are really a protection racket. So what that means is that, you know, first of all, if the president gets the concessions he wants from allies, he'll remain there to protect those allies. So you're not getting American military restraint. But also, what would happen in the event of an actual war? So Russia invades the Baltic states.
Yeah.
A president that thinks of alliances as a protection racket will then turn around and go, okay, well, we got our benefits. Why should we now pay this enormous cost?
Yeah.
So why does this work for Europeans either?
No, it's very unclear who it works for. And actually, I think I want to see some very interesting contradictions on the European side as well. Like, I do think that initially their approach was like sort of like flattery, like let's give Trump the sense that he's getting what he wants and then we can keep the U.S. in. And I think that, you know, like one real barrier to burden shifting has been like, do the European elites actually want this? Or are they like really committed to the existing NATO structure? And I think that with everything, there's a spectrum and there's different tendencies. And I see more evidence that like people in France are thinking in terms of a post-America world than like, say, in Germany, where it does seem they're still like super committed to being in NATO, even if that means making enormous concessions to Trump, who might not even like, you know, as you suggest, take those concessions seriously.
I think you're right. I think the needle's moving. Even where Germany really stands today is a question.
Yeah.
But Europe remains divided on this score. Mm-hmm. The country is right up on Russia's borders, like the Baltic states. They remain more trusting of the U.S. security guarantee than of anything that Europeans could collectively provide them with. So it's still a divided Europe. And that in turn means that even those governments elsewhere in Europe who actually don't like this where we're heading at all and would rather just understand, okay, if the U.S. is going to pull back, tell us where.
Yeah.
And let's get on with it. They are reluctant to throw under the bus their European allies. And remember, the alternative policy relies on Europe having a greater sense of unity. Mm-hmm. So starting off by having a huge rupture within Europe isn't a good way to go. So really, it's Washington that needs to act and be the mover and say, this is what we're doing. Now, they should consult with European allies as they're formulating plans. But I think the decisive act needs to come from Washington to say, this is what we're doing for reasons of our own interest. Mm-hmm. But it's a reasonable plan that allows Europe to step in as we step back. And then I'm more confident than ever before that Europe will be able to contend with that proposition. And there will even be people who support it, mm-hmm. even though it'll be controversial for some period of time. But let's see it happen. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, but for that scenario, you would need a president committed to clarity. And to like, you know, like, let's correct. Lay out a vision, planning, which is the opposite of what we currently have. We're getting near the end of the podcast, but there's one other issue that you had raised after your New York Times piece, which I think is maybe worth thinking about, which is a criticism of, you know, the general stance that you and I have been articulating of like a more restrained American foreign policy, a move towards a burden sharing and having allies take responsibility. There's a critique that this would lead to greater nuclear proliferation. And I just wanted to like just address that point, because I think that's an important one. And I think that is actually, you know, gets to the nub of the issue of like, you know, like what's a way forward out of this morass and what are the problems one would encounter along the way?
Glad you mentioned that, because I think truly the greatest trade-off lies in this issue. I think in many ways, the course that I recommend would just be better for the United States, except for this part, mm-hmm. right? Here, there is a trade-off, because it is true that American military dominance has kept some U.S. allies from acquiring nuclear weapons themselves. And we've in several cases, stopped allies who were looking to acquire nuclear weapons from doing so. Now, the price of that is that the United States extends its nuclear umbrella over those mm-hmm. allies, as well as protecting them through conventional military means. So I think it's fair to say that if allies are more empowered, they have more autonomy, that some are likely to want to get nuclear weapons. Might not happen immediately, but I expect it probably will happen. And I think the trade-off is worth it. I think Europeans in particular ought to be planning for a world in which there is an independent European nuclear deterrent in some form. If the United States does back away conventionally from Europe, it's not going to make a whole lot of sense for the U.S. to be rendering itself redundant in European defense, except that we're willing to put our cities at risk.
Yeah.
So they need to start planning for that eventuality. That said, our current policy, our current strategy of primacy, if it disincentivizes nuclear acquisition by allies, it incentivizes nuclear acquisition and proliferation by American adversaries. Just look at our record of attacking countries like Libya, precisely because they gave up nuclear weapons. And that's been noticed by, you know, North Korea. Iran is now having to think about its own calculation. So if the United States pulls back, that negative dynamic will also be reduced when it comes to nuclear proliferation. And the final thing I'll say is that I'm not somebody who thinks I'm going to see the end of nuclear weapons in the world in my lifetime or my children's lifetime. And so that's not really my orientation. And while I would prefer, I don't think more nuclear weapons is better, as some do. That's a view associated with the realist scholar Ken Waltz. But I also don't think, you know, some more nuclear weapons or some more states with nuclear weapons is the worst thing in the world. If we're moving toward a more multipolar world, it actually makes sense that we might see that behavior, and there are better and worse ways to bring it about. In particular, I mean, there are people who would argue, you know, we can't, we'd have to defend Taiwan and wage World War III against China, or else then China takes over Taiwan, and then maybe Japan and South Korea get nuclear weapons because they're more concerned about their security. I'm sorry. Like, I, first of all, I'm not sure that they would need nuclear weapons, but okay. I mean, if the alternative is an all-out war between the United States and China, World War III, and much less over a place that's quite difficult for the United States to defend, then we ought to be open to thinking realistically about, you know, what does the world look like if we don't have World War III?
Yeah.
And in that respect, you know, a Japan or South Korea with nuclear weapons like looks like a less bad choice to me. So that's kind of how I think about the issue, but I admit this is a, you know, this is a hard one.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is absolutely a hard decision, but I will end on the note by reiterating something that you just said, which is that the current policy itself is encouraging nuclear proliferation. Like, I actually can't see how anyone can look at what the U.S. did with Iran and think it's less logical now for the Iranians to have nuclear weapons, rather than it's much more logical. And that applies to, like, many other parts of the world. So given that, you know, very dire status quo, I think the alternative that you're outlining makes a lot of sense. And more, you know, broadly to conclude, like, I actually do think that it's very valuable to actually, you know, think in terms of trade-offs and think in terms of, like, a foreign policy that, like, acknowledges, you know, the sort of imperfect world and choices that have to be made, because that's a rational way to look at things. And it's also not the way that Washington is currently looking at things, or at least, like, many parts of Washington. I'm sure there are people in the Pentagon and the State Department that are thinking about these issues of trade-offs, but, like, one is not actually seeing that in American foreign policy. On that note, I want to thank you again for being on the podcast and for your excellent article in the New York Times, which we'll link to in the show notes.
Thank you. My pleasure.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker dealer.